The melting point of gold is 1,947 degrees Fahrenheit. That falls into the same temperature range needed to cremate a human body. In other words, if we were going to go through the same process that gold needs to go through in order to become what we want it to become, we would turn into ashes. Okay? And I bring this up because God in Scripture symbolizes us Christians as gold, which needs to be refined. And Christians have long recognized God's intent to do that to us. You go back all the way to what they say is the first book ever written of the Bible. That would be the book of Job, older than any other text in Scripture. In chapter 23, verse 10, Job says, "When God has tested me, I will come forth as gold." Job knew it. Malachi knew it. Chapter 3, verse 3, he says, "God sits like a refiner, burning away the dross. He purifies us like gold." This is what God does to his people. Refinement like this only happens under intense heat. And the kind of heat that we're referring to in life is suffering. The kind of refinement that we must undergo, the kind that happens by God's hand, equates to suffering. Isaiah 48, verse 10 says, "I have tested you," God says, "in the furnace of affliction." And so the purification process in a Christian's life, which is also known as sanctification, it necessitates the enduring of temperatures, if you will, that would otherwise kill them. And so not every believer that goes through this process is going to necessarily go through actual fire, but of course some have, and we read about three of them tonight in the book of Daniel, and this is a very, very popular account. I'm going to back up to verse 14 of the same chapter and begin reading there. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to these three young men, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now, if you're ready, at the time you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, and the psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you fall down, worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace seven times more than it was usually heated, and he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning, fiery furnace. Now, if you remember from last month, Nebuchadnezzar has built a gold statue, great big thing. If I remember right, it was 90 feet tall. He set it up in the plain of Dura, and then he organized this just great venue whereby everyone in Babylon could prove their patriotism by bowing. Really, it was meant to promote unity among what had become a very diversified populace. There was Assyrians there and Babylonians and Egyptians and, of course, Jews, all kinds of people from different areas. And so the goal there was to bring everybody together and unite them around, I guess, religion. So everyone was there, everyone from the greatest to the least, everyone from high to low. There was, the officials, the governors, all the way down to the common people. So even in their ranks, they were there. And it was a situation where any non-compliance would be considered an unwarranted act of treason, okay? And really ridiculously unnecessary. Why wouldn't you bow, okay? just irritating to anybody who, oh, there's that guy and he just won't do it. You get the point here. It's a irritating thing for them. And it would be akin to maybe not taking your hat off and putting your hand over your heart during the national anthem at maybe the World Series or something big like that, where everybody's watching, you feel the pressure to do so, and so you just go along with it, and most would. Now, the whole atmosphere there on the plain of Dura was charged with a spirit of peer pressure. You had better do it, and no questions will be asked of you. But these three young Jewish men have already resolved not bow to this statue because that would constitute idolatry. And God already told them in Exodus 20, if I'm not mistaken, that they shouldn't have any other gods. So they remembered the commands. They knew this already from their upbringing. And so they weren't about to exercise what would equate to blatant disobedience before God, not without violating their conscience, which they weren't willing to do. And so that's the situation before us this evening. In verse 21, it says that these men were then bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and then they were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. So, in they go, right? They have no idea at this point whether they're going to live or whether they're going to die. They've already kind of confessed that in verse 18. God can deliver us from this furnace and from your hand, O king. And even if he doesn't, of course, there's the possibility that we die. Well, if we die, let it be known for forevermore that we weren't willing to bow to your gods. So they're not sure. They don't know whether they're going to die or whether they're going to live. And if they live, how long this torture is going to last. Warren Wiersbe makes an interesting comment on this. He says, when God puts his own people into the furnace, he keeps his eye on the clock and his hand on the thermostat. He knows how long and how much. If we rebel, he may have to reset the clock. But if we submit, he will not permit us to suffer 1 minute too long. I like that. When God puts us into a fiery furnace of trial, he keeps his eye on the clock and his hand on the thermostat. He won't keep you in any minute longer than you need to be in that trial. But if you rebel, he's going to reset the clock. We never know how long our suffering is going to last once it begins. It could last perhaps a moment. Perhaps it could go on for the duration of an entire season, maybe a lifetime. But God will accomplish the job. He will refine you as gold. You remember Philippians 1:6. He who began a good work in you will carry it through to completion. Oftentimes we look at that verse and it warms our hearts. Boy, I think that verse ought to cause us a little bit of fear. If he starts the process of refinement, he's not going to quit until it's finished. In verse 22, it says, therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed the men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Notice they weren't thrown in. They fell. They fell down into the furnace. Why is that? Because the guards that would have thrown them in were totally incinerated. I don't know if they were turned into ash immediately, but they died on the spot. So what that means then is the very last thing that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego saw as they fell into the furnace was these men's death. And I think that that happened to prove a point to these guys and to us. God is going to put you through as a Christian that which would spell the end for most others. God is going to put you through things that would kill someone else. He will throw you into situations that your contemporaries weren't able to survive. As a Christian in the church, you're going to see people perish when they come up against the same fiery trial that God is now facing you with, and you watched them die, but now you have fallen into the same lot. How terrifying. I mean, falling into a fiery furnace of that nature wasn't scary enough already, watching these guys die would have only added to the fear. But what killed them won't kill you. That's the guarantee we have as Christians. What kills others won't kill you. Listen to me. The great proof of saving faith, the great proof of saving faith is that you survive the same lethal ordeal that killed others around you. Okay? So if you're uncertain, if you're ever not clear of whether you're a real Christian or not, then maybe God needs to introduce you to some real suffering. Okay? Not necessarily to see for himself whether you have faith or not, but to show you whether you have faith or not. If you're uncertain, wait till God puts you through a trial. You'll find out once and for all whether you have a genuine saving faith or not. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 6 to 7, Peter writes about this. He says, there's a wonderful joy ahead, even though you must endure many trials for a little while. There's a wonderful joy waiting for you through and on the other side of trial. He says, these trials will show that your faith is genuine. That's one of the great purposes of suffering in our life, is to prove to us that our faith is genuine. Peter says it's being tested as fire tests and purifies gold, although your faith is far more precious than mere gold. Far more precious. Thomas Brooks comments on the preciousness of our faith, saying, of all God's gifts, faith makes the soul most invincible, so you should labor above all to be rich in faith. It renders the soul unconquerable under all the hardships and trials which it meets with in this world. Faith makes a man triumph in all the changes and conditions of this life. So, what Thomas Brooks is saying is strive to have a refined faith, which means then don't shy away from trouble. Don't worry about the trials that God brings you into. The sad truth is, not everybody has saving faith. Not every Christian who believes that themselves to be a Christian, not every Christian has saving faith. Not everybody in the church has saving faith. You know who does and who doesn't, because those who do will be spared, those who don't will be burned. You always know, trial by fire, who's who. So see to it that the faith you have is real, and let the Lord test it now so that it won't be proven false after it's too late. Verse 24 says, then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said to the king, true, O king. Look, he answered, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Most scholars agree that this fourth man is more than an angel, okay? That this is, in fact, a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. So God doesn't just use hardship and persecution in our life to refine our character, though that's one of the reasons he allows it. It's to refine your character. It isn't just to test our faith, though it does test your faith and prove it genuine or fraudulent. But God also allows hardship into our life to offer us deeper fellowship with Jesus. Never before, as far as the record of Daniel is concerned, have these three young men had fellowship with God like they are enjoying right then and there in the furnace of affliction. They have never had fellowship this intimate. That's because the Lord reserves the most intimate fellowship for those who faithfully embrace anguish and suffering inherent to remaining faithful to Him. God shows up in a more real and tangible way to those who gladly endure suffering on His behalf. Philippians 3:10, the Apostle Paul admitted, I want to know Christ and the fellowship of His suffering. I want that in my life. You don't hear Christians talk like that very often. I want to suffer. Do you? I'm asking you a question. Do you want to suffer? Paul says, yes, Sign me up. That's what I want. Peter said, you should be glad when you suffer for your faith, because trials make you partners with Christ in his sufferings. Are you glad when you suffer? I'm asking a question. Are you glad when you suffer? Peter says, you should be. Your suffering makes you partners with Christ. Were these three young Jewish men glad? It doesn't say, does it? But did you know that in some alternate translations or manuscripts of this text, it actually suggests that they were singing? Not in the inspired word of God, but there are some other accounts that record that they were singing. Whether they were or not is beside the point. If God wanted us to know that they were, he would put it in the Bible. But we have no reason to believe they weren't. You know why? Because many have. There have been many Christian martyrs over the duration of church history who have sung praises to God as they burned at the stake. One source tells us that Christian history is filled with stories of martyrs who went to their own deaths joyfully, often singing hymns, sometimes even telling jokes. Their joy at their own deaths testifies to the clarity of the Christian hope. A joy in the face of death that has long puzzled the world. And I think the world is puzzled when they look at this. The world is puzzled when they look at a guy like John Huss. He was the Bohemian reformer who was burned at the stake in 1415 and sang while he cooked. Sang praises to God as the flames licked his body. Jerome of Prague, he was burned alive as well. Online source tells us that he prepared for the fire as if he were going to a marriage feast. He uttered no cry of pain. When the flames rose, he began to sing. In fact, we're told that he died singing, and his last words were, quote, "This burning soul I offer to you, Christ." That was, I guess, the lyrics. He just sang that. This burning soul I offer to you, Christ. This, I don't know how it went. Could you imagine that? How inspiring. So did these three men sing like that? I don't know, but others have. Martin Lloyd-Jones says, Christian people are generally at their best when they're in the furnace of affliction and being persecuted and tried. Christians are generally at their best when they're in this. Do you agree with that? Well, they brought the best out of John Huss, Jerome of Prague. Do these kinds of trials bring out the best in you? Do you sing praise to God when you're going through the ringer? Consider that. What's your attitude? Guys, I'm not meaning to ridicule you here. I think if we're honest, all of us, including me, we don't suffer very well. Our faith needs even further refining. In the 19th century, a family from a small village in India converted to Christianity. The community there became so upset at their conversion that an angry mob gathered and shoved them into the public square. The father of the family was confronted by their village chief and was told that their entire family would surely die if they didn't recant their faith. The only thing that came to mind for the father were the words of the song that he had himself composed when he first surrendered his life to God. So all he could think was the song that he had written at some point. And so the man began to sing, "I have decided to follow Jesus, no turning back, no turning back." Now that song we are familiar with. I have decided to follow Jesus, no turning back, right? No turning back. And with that, his children were killed. The man was given another chance to save his wife, but he continued to sing, and she too was killed. Then he was given one last opportunity to save himself, but still he sang. Even though the man and his family died on that day, something remarkable happened. A seed was planted in the heart of that village chief. Eventually, the chief called the community together in the same square and renounced his own beliefs to declare himself a Christian. Celebrations took place at this announcement, and commitments to Christ began to spread across the entire region, all because of a demonstration of real faith. They knew the true character of God because of a family who believed and sacrificed even under the penalty of death. So God doesn't just use suffering to refine our character, though he does. He doesn't just use suffering to test our faith, though he does. He doesn't just use suffering to bring us into more deep and intimate fellowship with his Son, though that's part of it. He also uses suffering to reveal himself to other people through you, to unbelievers who are watching you suffer, people who have never seen such faith in action like that before. And it didn't become apparent until you were chosen to suffer in their view, right? Nebuchadnezzar, when he saw this, he was, quote, astonished. That's what it says. King Nebuchadnezzar, in verse 24, was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying, did we not cast these three guys into the fire? They're up and walking around, and I see four. Nebuchadnezzar is shocked. Right? But I'll tell you who wasn't surprised. The three young Jewish men who were in the furnace. They weren't surprised at all. They knew all along that God could save. They had already announced that to Nebuchadnezzar before they fell into the furnace. This was no surprise to them. So if we are astonished at this, then we're more in line with Nebuchadnezzar's reaction than anybody else's. If we're astonished at the faith of John Huss, or Jerome of Prague, or anybody else in the Indian village, and we say things like, I don't know how they were able to do that, then we are as unbelieving and as unfamiliar with God's power as Nebuchadnezzar was, and we should know better. We as Christians should know better about the power of God to preserve a person through trial, because we've been in it, because if we're children, God has put us through it. And if we have genuine faith, we've endured faithfully. We shouldn't be surprised. Let the unbelievers who know nothing of the power of God, let them be astonished. Let Nebuchadnezzar be astonished. Let the unbelievers in your life be astonished when you go through suffering and don't complain. Let everybody else be shocked when they see you so composed under pressure. And again, I think some of us are really ashamed at how often our faith fails. You know, when Jesus says, oh, you have little faith. For some of us, that's our life verse. Oh, you have little faith. And we have to admit that sometimes we buckle. And this again is why James says, count it joy when you fall into trials, for what those trials promise to produce in you. Count it all joy. You're given by God, in his grace, a chance to be refined, that you fail less, that you fall under pressure less than you have heretofore. In verse 26, Nebuchadnezzar then went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. And so then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire, and the satraps, administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. That obviously is a remarkable supernatural act of God, that their hair wasn't singed. There's no smell of smoke on them, nothing like this. The only thing that the fire burned up were the ropes that bound them. If you notice, when they were brought to the mouth of the furnace and they fell in, they were bound with their garments, bound by ropes. I don't know what it was. But now they're up and walking around. Obviously, they were unbound. And the only thing that God allowed to burn away were the ropes that confined them. They used to be tied up, but not now. And that's what affliction does. When we are faithful through trial, The only thing that it does is to free you from the cumbersome sins you had before you went through it. That's all. Doesn't harm you at all. Trials are not bad for you. Trials do not scar you. Trials do not psychologically harm you. Trials are healthy and good and God-ordained. The only thing they do is to free you from the cumbersome sins you had before you went through those trials, whether that was fear of man. Trials have a way of purifying you from a fear of man. Maybe doubts about your faith. The fiery trials in this life have a way of burning away any doubt of your faith and clarifying for you that you do trust in the Lord. The things that burn away under trial are the self-confidence, too much self-confidence that we have. Resistance toward God. The ropes that bind us, sometimes it's just spiritual boredom, is burned away like chaff after you've gone through some heat. It ain't boring. You're wide awake now, alert and ready to serve the Lord like you should. Charles Spurgeon says, you'll never know the fullness of spiritual liberty until you've been put through the fire. In Psalm 119, David wrote, before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I keep your word. Suffering was good for me because it taught me to pay attention. Puritan Thomas Manton, he says, trial isn't just to approve, but to improve. Trials improve upon a person dramatically in many ways. No more ropes for these three young men, no more restrictions. Only freedom now. They're less restricted coming out of it than they were before they went in. In verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies, that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. I don't know if you caught that, but if you look again at verse 28, we're going to see in that verse the four key elements to saving faith. Four key elements. And these come from the mouth of a pagan king, by the way. Even Nebuchadnezzar can recognize what they are. The first one, trust. Trust. Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him. That's the first element in saving faith, trust. Trust that's not just in word only. Lip service is cheap, and Jesus always knew that. It's not in word only, but it's kind of trust that's shown in the decisions that a person makes in their life. It's the kind of trust they have in God at a time when their life is on the line. That's when trust really counts, when your future is in jeopardy. How cheap of a trust do we have in God when we say we believe in him, but we deny his word to preserve our own life and welfare? Oh, I believe it. Oh, I trust the Lord. But when it comes down to it and things get a little bit sketchy, we don't trust in the Lord. We trust in our finances. We trust in our bank. We trust in our job. We trust in worldly resources. We trust in mom and dad. We trust in our government. We trust in anything, anybody, or anything can ever do to help us. And we turn away from God in order to grab a hold of something else in which we trust. Isn't it funny that that's what our money says? In God we trust? If paper could be hypocritical. At any rate, the second element is fear. Fear of God, by the way, not man. Blessed be the God of these three who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and they have frustrated the king's word. Nebuchadnezzar says, they frustrated my word. What that means is they violated my command. These guys weren't afraid to disobey me because they were too afraid of disobeying God. So fear is the second key element in saving faith. Fear of God, not of man. Their fear of Nebuchadnezzar was eclipsed by their fear of Jesus Christ. And when Nebuchadnezzar said, bow, and God said, don't, somebody's command had to be violated. and they chose to violate Nebuchadnezzar's command rather than violate God's command. The third element is sacrifice. You notice Nebuchadnezzar praises them because they, quote, yielded their bodies. They trusted in him, they frustrated the king's word, and they yielded their bodies. That, my friends, is what we call sacrifice, and sacrifice is the third key element in saving faith. They yielded their bodies. In other words, their faith wasn't a thing of the imagination. You following me? It was tangible. It was in the real world. It was physical. It was bodily. Bodily. These three men weren't so shallow as to think it was enough to honor God with their lips only. They knew that to deny Jesus physically was to deny him spiritually. Nobody can say that they have faith in Jesus if their actions contradict that claim. You can say you believe in Jesus, but if your actions contradict that, then you don't have faith in Jesus. The last thing that Nebuchadnezzar notices here is their fidelity. Look at the last line of that verse. They wouldn't serve or worship any god except their own. They weren't divided in their loyalty. They weren't interested in serving two or more masters while pretending to serve only one. When something in their life interfered with their devotion to Jesus, they rejected it out of hand. They would have nothing to do with it. Just because it was normal in that culture to do so, or expected of them to have at least two gods, or just because it seemed perhaps like they had to do it because everybody else is doing it, none of those things were a good enough excuse for them. They wouldn't compromise on God. And so those, my friends, are the four key elements of faith. Can you recite them with me? There was trust, there was fear, there was sacrifice, and there was fidelity. So I ask you, do you trust God to deliver you from threatening circumstances? Or do you only trust him while life is calm and comfortable and then take control of the situation when things get serious? Do you fear the Lord? Who do you fear? Is it God or is it man? Are you more concerned with man's opinion of you or God's? Are you more concerned with man's verdict of you or of God's? Are you more concerned of man's wrath towards you or of God's? Who do you fear? And how about sacrifice? Does your faith or what you say you believe ever cause you to yield your physical body to what might kill it? Have you ever, quote, risked your neck for the gospel? Have you ever found yourself in a situation where something you cherish, including your own body, was at risk of being eliminated because of your faith in Jesus? Or are you all talk? Romans 12:1 says, present your body as a living sacrifice. Do you take Romans 12:1 literally, or is Paul just talking figuratively? Present your literal body as a living sacrifice, or just hypothetically? And lastly, are you known for your fidelity? Are you known as a man or a woman who is devoted exclusively to God, or are you spiritually adulterous? Those are your two choices. You are either loyal to God, faithful to God, you are either committed to him in a relationship of fidelity, or you are prostituting yourself to other gods, trusting other gods, faithful to other gods, sacrificing yourself to other gods, sacrificing the things of your life to other gods. If you can affirm all of these things, that you trust him, that you fear him, that you sacrifice to him, and that you live a life of fidelity before him, if you can affirm all of these, then, my friend, your faith is genuine, and it will pass the test of affliction. If not, then your faith needs further testing. In verse 29, Nebuchadnezzar continues and says, therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap. Because there's no other God who can deliver like this. And so then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. It's interesting, because if you look at what he said in verse 29, that's exactly what Jesus says in Matthew 24, 51. If you won't worship God, you will die. Matthew 24, 51 says, God will cut the faithless in pieces, just like Nebuchadnezzar said would happen to those who don't acknowledge the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. God will cut the faithless in pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites where there will be gnashing and weeping and gnashing of teeth. So Nebuchadnezzar is making the same promise to the citizens of Babylon that God has made to the rest of the world since then. If you deny me, I will cut you in pieces and appoint your portion with the hypocrites. Okay? Weeping and gnashing of teeth. And then if you look at verse 30, what Nebuchadnezzar did for those is exactly what God says he'll do for us. Nebuchadnezzar promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. God says in Revelation 2:26, to the one who is victorious and does my will to the end, I will give authority over the nations. That's a great promise. In fact, there's a lot of scholars who see in this account a great parallel between what happened here on a small scale and what will happen on a global scale in the end. Very interesting to see the correlations. But we look at this account insofar as it relates to me and you in the here and now. What was it about these guys that gave them, these three Jewish boys, the ability to stand strong through such a difficult trial? What was it? What did they have? And what do we lack if, in fact, we would fall in such a situation as theirs? What they had, I'll tell you this, was a firm foundation. They had built for themselves a structure upon a foundation more solid than most people care to build. Jesus, when he told parables, spoke of two men, one who built his house on a rock, you remember this, another man was building a similar home, but he built it on unstable ground, shifting sand. In time, storms came, and those storms represent the afflictions God promises us, the storms of life, if you will. Those storms came, and if you know the parable, only one house stood when the clouds cleared. So trials came upon both men, but one of them didn't make it. Why? Because of the preliminary work he had failed to do before the storm came. Only one of them cared enough and was careful enough and diligent enough to be building on that rock. The other one was haphazardly living his quasi-Christian life with some fraudulent faith that in the end proved to be worthless. That's the difference. Zechariah 13:9, God says, I will bring them through fire, refining them as silver is refined and testing them as gold is tested. That is as sure a promise as you could find in Scripture. God says, I will do that. That isn't limited to the Jewish people, by the way. This is anyone who calls upon the name of Christ. Affliction is inevitable for God's children. The question is, will you stand? Even according to that parable, the storms came to both houses. Storms will come, but will you stand? These three men were able to pass through unscathed, faithful as they were, because they didn't waste their years in Israel living in compromise, so that by the time they got to Babylon, and more specifically the fiery furnace, they stood strong because they had been building on solid rock. So that when the trials of life were thrust upon them, they came through the other side unscathed. Now, if you want to stand strong when God tests you, then you ought to be being faithful even now. If you're faithful now, then you will be faithful when suffering comes. If you are not being faithful right now, you won't. You won't. Why would you? Are you just waiting to really give it all? Waiting until the trial comes to really step it up and invest in the Lord and kingdom work and faith in Christ? Are we waiting for hardship to befall us before we really decide to get serious about Jesus? Proverbs 24:10 warns and says, if you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. It's not saying you don't have any strength. It's just saying it's not very strong strength. Some of us, we need to be refined. And if we are faithful through the smaller of refinements now, we will be faithful when the refinements get even hotter. So let God do his work in you now. Trust him with your life now. Yield your body, yield yourself to his plan now, and you will remain faithful to the end.